Today I'm going to talk a lot about transparency, which I don't think is going to be a very radical subject to this group, which is at a conference committed to open access, where transparency appeared in the slides related to some papers here. But what I'm going to talk about is a little bit of technical transparency and a lot of non-technical transparency, and to try to relate it to people's lives a little bit, because it is something that is actually can be pretty hard to actually deal with in practice. So I work for a part of the U.S. government. It's relatively new. The agency I work for is not new. It's called the General Services Administration. Inside the General Services Administration, there's a relatively new team that started up a few years ago called 18F, focused very much on like digital services, a lot of web stuff, like a lot of usability research, trying to make federal government services be responsive to user needs. But it also means we employ a ton of engineers in the federal government as full-time federal employees, which is unfortunately rather unusual. And we, as an organization, have staked out a really strong claim right from the beginning that we work in the open, just full stop, right? So every single piece of software that we write is open source. We try to do all of our usability research publicly. We just, in general, operate in the open. So I also, before working in the government, I worked for an organization called the Sunlight Foundation, which, when I was there, had a team of about 15 or 16 engineers and a nonprofit of 50 people working specifically on making governments here and around the world more transparent and in trying to demonstrate how data and accountability fostered better results. So I was there for about 5 years before this, where I really kind of caught the bug on transparency. Nowadays, I work more on security and privacy issues, where a transparency background is actually pretty unusual. So I want to talk about transparency because everybody says that they love it. It's a very easy thing to get some points for giving lip service to. But you know, when you actually bring this up, when real decisions are about to be made, you know, you start getting lines about maybe not wanting to give a roadmap to hackers about your system, or people are concerned about data. They'll mumble mosaic effect, like maybe things could be connected. People get concerned that, you know, inviting the public out there might cause your decisions to be politicized in some way or pandering in some way. And also people are just concerned about speed, right? Like people are just like, look, we know what to do. We've just got to get it done. Like, don't bog us down in this process stuff. Right? So it's basically, a lot of the times it's actually transparency, like until it feels the least bit uncomfortable for any reason whatsoever. Right? And that's... been my experience working in that field for a while. So I'm going to try to focus a little bit on this talk on how transparency can improve privacy and security. And these are very simple things, right? These are publishing data information, specifically explaining concepts to a wider audience. It's about the process and about making that actually welcoming and easy and open. And I think in general, an important part that doesn't get talked about quite as much is actually just being willing to assume open by default and put the burden on people to argue otherwise for how to work. So these are simple concepts, but they are surprisingly not simple to actually ship when decisions with any sort of stakes involved need to be made. So my flaw in giving presentations is that I tend to have a lot of slides and whip through them fairly fast. There's like 90 slides in here. It will probably go a little bit quick, and so I'm gonna leave time at the end for questions, and we'll try to make up for my weaknesses in that way. I'm going to try to make each point understandable, and there's a lot of pictures along the way. So the Web PKI, I'm going to focus on an internet example and a government example. All right, so I want to talk about the Web PKI generally, because I think at the core of what has been improving about the Web PKI and what makes it something that is actually, you can reasonably put some technical guarantees in these days and in the near future, relates to transparency, both the technical and non-technical kind. I'm not going to spend much time with this audience on explaining the technical underpinnings of the Web PKI or HTTPS. I think folks here get that, you know, confidentiality, authenticity, integrity are the basic properties, hiding most of the information on the wire, making sure you're actually talking to the person who owns the private key for that domain name, and making sure information isn't tampered with to and from the service that you're talking to. But the fact is that HTTPS, which will probably be about a little over half the talk is talking about HTTPS-related stuff, It has unreasonable requirements, like completely unreasonable. It means that the user, you cannot require the user to pay attention to anything at all. Any errors or warnings had really better be for the right reason, like it's not okay to just to have warning fatigue develop, even though that's still, in many cases, kind of the situation that we have. It's still not okay. Importantly, you cannot do like tofu for like trust on first use for every website. Right? It can't work like Signal does, where you just trust the key the first time, but you know, and then you pin going forward. Right? That's not, that won't work for the web and the long tail of the web. And also importantly, like domain owners will change hands. Like people will give domain names to each other. As you know, the keys will change, the certs will change, and it has to just work for everybody. That's super unreasonable to do, but it unfortunately is the only widely deployed encryption method in the entire world that seems to just work for regular people. So given these unreasonable requirements, you have some very unreasonable solutions for dealing with that. And it's basically corporations trusting a bunch of other corporations and governments on your behalf in a way you have very little control over. And that is how the WebPKI works today, right? So Microsoft, Google, Apple, Mozilla, they will each essentially vet a set of corporations and some governments, and then give those organizations essentially a blanket right on your computer, if you use that platform for your OS or your browser, to issue any certificate that you will trust whatsoever, right? And problems happen all the time. Like, it really, I mean, it sounds like a problematic system, and it totally is, and there have been a number of very significant problems over the years. Some of the stuff that's come out of that, right, there's now much more intensive focus on standards across the board for the WebPKI. Part of that is the CA Browser Forum formalizing what are called the baseline requirements for the issuance and management of public adjusted certificates. They came together and voted on that and made a thing in 2011, shortly after the DigiNotar and Komodo attacks. It came into effect in 2012, and they've revised it ever since with a series of votes by CAs, by certificate authorities and browsers. But that doesn't have any force, right? The only organizations who actually give any teeth to those baseline requirements are the platforms who choose to require those things of certificate authorities, right? So you have Microsoft has their own trusted root program with all their own requirements. Apple has their own root program. You can basically just sum up the whole Apple program as like we do what we want, but they do also refer you to the baseline requirements. Mozilla has one, and very importantly for this talk, they require that all of the decisions that they make about their root program and about who's trusted in Mozilla platforms be done through a public process. And what might not be obvious is that Google generally just fully relies on the Mozilla process. And I've included a screenshot of the Android documentation telling people, like, if you want to be on Android, go through the Mozilla process. But it also includes the fact that on the Mozilla decision-making board, which is the sort of module peers, that it also actually includes a Google employee who helps participate and adjudicate that stuff. Google is also quite invested. So you have to go through the Mozilla process, not just for Firefox and not just for, you know, being on Linux and stuff, but for a very significant chunk of the world. So the Mozilla process, the public process, there's a Bugzilla tracker, and some stuff happens there, but I will say the juiciest place is just like a mailing list where most of the stuff happens. Right? And this screenshot in February, you can see like has a bunch of things that sound really interesting. You have one CA like ratting on another CA to say they violated the baseline requirements. You have like, hey, this is a SHA-1 certificate that got issued that was a violation. You have Amazon saying something about a Google CA, somebody complaining about a Let's Encrypt certificate. It's really great stuff, and it can be quite feisty. And really, like, there's a lot of people from all over the world who will go and participate who aren't like, you know, who don't work for a platform or a CA, myself included. But actually, the quality of the dialogue tends to be pretty high. So I'll get back to that. The other big thing in the WebPKI that's been transformative has been certificate transparency, which is a technical mechanism with a lot of non-technical ramifications. So certificate transparency, to vastly oversimplify it, is a little like a blockchain light. It's a Merkle tree-based construction where you just can log any certificate. Anybody can log a certificate as long as the log trusts that root that it comes from. or the log has decided to accept things for the root that comes from. And they're append only, and you can verify that the log hasn't retroactively changed anything. So it's a way of trying to demonstrate that certificates are publicly logged in a way that can't be taken back, and in a way that outside folks can verify. So you can today go and, like, I just searched for usenix.org. You can go and see all the certificates that have been used for different usenix. I mean, this might not be all, because not everything is in CT, but at this point, most things are, and there's only going to be more. So you can actually go and see all those things. This is started to. This was originally designed for the purpose of things like this. So this is Facebook saying, hey, thanks, certificate transparency. It let us find that somebody issued a certificate for fb.com for a subdomain that didn't like comply with our enterprise IT policy. It also could have been an attacker. In this case, it was a vendor related to Facebook who, you know, issued a, kind of went off the ranch of Facebook's internal policies that they found. But obviously, if it had been an attacker, that also, they also would have found it the same way. And that was sort of the original goal for certificate transparency was this, like letting Google and Facebook and whoever else feels like watching these CT logs to see demonstrably that when something was issued for their products that shouldn't have been. Similarly, so the Mozilla root program now requires that people disclose any certificate authority certificate that's capable of issuing anything. So these are This is from crt.sh, which is a CT log viewer, and they also include this page where they tie into Mozilla's internal disclosure database, and where they basically take things that they see in the universe of certificate transparency, and they find things that certificate authorities have not told Mozilla about that they should have. This has uncovered lots of really interesting stuff. It seems to be something that certificate authorities have a huge problem complying with in a reasonable way of just telling Mozilla about who can issue certificates. And it has been really informative for the whole community about to inform future policy work in that area. When Symantec in 2015, so I'll get to their recent thing soon, but in 2015, there was a public dispute between Google and Symantec where Symantec issued a bunch of little test certificates that were valid for commonly used web services. And Symantec produced a public audit saying, like, oh, sorry about that. That was an accident, but you know, we contained the damage, it was limited to these certificates, our bad. And then after that, Google, and this is in their public blog post, they said, we're still able to find several more questionable certificates using only CT logs and a few minutes of work. That is a brutal and insulting blog post to Symantec, and was another use of CT to do something that would have been very difficult to do before. More recently, there in late 2016, there was a kerfuffle between Mozilla and WoSign, a Chinese CA, who, as it turns out, had purchased StartCom, which is, I believe, an Israeli-based CA. This is an incident report that Mozilla drafted, and as part of that incident report, they went and they analyzed huge amounts of certificate data to basically prove that the CEO of WoSign had actively lied to them directly and on the list about it backdating SHA-1 certificates. So SHA-1 certificates had been banned for issuance as of, I believe, January 1st, 2016. And some certificates were issued that were dated with an initial date of late 2015, but that was not the case. Right? And so they were able to do some interesting analysis to basically pin the CEO of WoSign down to like when he was physically in the office and must have approved the certificate. I really encourage you to read the full incident report. It's a really great document that Mozilla published. Interestingly, they also were able to prove who the payments processor was that requested the SHA-1 certificate from WoSign, and that WoSign like lied to browsers to protect the issuance of. And they were just doing that essentially with certificate transparency logs. In fact, when this report was published, Tyro immediately, like within, I don't know, an hour or so, published a blog post being like, hey, I just read this paper from Mozilla that names us, like, you know, we just wanted to do right by our merchants. There's a bunch of weird highlighting on there because this is from an archive site because they deleted the blog post very soon after that. But Mozilla kind of went out on a limb with their report, taking together a bunch of evidence from certificate transparency logs, and then Tyro completely proved them right. And most of that work, actually building up to that, a lot of the stuff that actually informed that discussion and supported their analysis took place over a few different months. This is from my inbox. Took place over a few months on the Mozilla security list. It was an intense amount of debate there and discussion. It even got Apple to ring in, and Apple basically never does this. Apple never says anything publicly about decisions that they're making like this or that are related to other companies. And Apple did not post it on their website. They posted it on the Mozilla Dev security policy list because that is where all the action happens. So that was like a, if there's any validation that the Mozilla list is where the work is, like it's because Apple bothered to publish something there. So I guess I'm starting to take a little bit long in this section, so I won't dwell on it too much, but you know, Symantec has been in a public spat with Google more recently with bigger stakes, right? So at this point, you have Symantec and Google doing dueling blog posts and mailing list threads, where Symantec is like publicly responding to Google and calling Google's claims exaggerated. In the meantime, there's starting to be leaks about Symantec looking to sell their certificate authority business. And this, again, began with a report based on things observed in certificate transparency logs in a report published to the Mozilla list. And even though the spat appears to be, and is in a lot of ways, between Google and Symantec, all of that discussion over months, and this is still very active, right, we're still waiting on the next thing from Symantec, are taking place on the Mozilla list. Most of Symantec's responses giving details as to all the different incidents that built up to these complaints are given because of deadlines that Mozilla set and Google also helped set with them as part of this process. And they have their own proposal that Symantec also has to take just as seriously. So certificate transparency, one of the things that, you know, even though this isn't being done yet, something that is about to happen is that certificate transparency can actually be technically enforced. Right, so without getting too much into the details in this talk, like certificates can be embedded at issuance time with cryptographic evidence of essentially a promise that that certificate has been logged, and then there are ways to go validate that promise that are also cryptographically based. Right, so you can actually, as a client, if you run a browser or some other client, you can set policies that require certain numbers and strengths of promises that certificate has been logged into the certificate, so that at validation time, the client can fail if the certificate cannot come up with any evidence that it has been logged. So Google has announced that they're going to do that for Chrome in 2017. It's actually been delayed to early 2018 since this thing, but that is what Chrome is working on. That is what Mozilla is also working on now. And that means that for certificates to validate on those platforms, they will need to have been publicly logged. And that really meaningfully catches and deters, to begin with, all sorts. I mean, it might not, you know, deter petty criminals, but it's definitely going to deter a lot of people who do not want to be detected, right, making these kinds of attacks. And that is a new thing. And I'll note that Let's Encrypt, the free CA, just publishes voluntarily all of the things to certificate transparency in part to support this. So that's a combination of data transparency and process transparency. I think those things feed into each other and support each other in a way that has been very helpful to the WebPKI. So I want to talk a little bit about the U.S., like what's been happening in the U.S. government over the last few years and still in this year in this administration around HTTPS. There are some interesting effects of the transparent approach that we've taken that I think are worth covering. So in the U.S. government, there is an executive branch policy that thou shalt use HTTPS and strict transport security for anything that talks over the public internet over HTTP at all. It is a really simple and really ambitious policy, and it came out in summer of 2015. It is still in effect. Executive branch policies like this that relate to IT that come from the Management Budget Office carry over. There are things that have been in effect there for 15, 20 years. That's actively supported this year. So, you know, it won't shock anybody here to hear that the U.S. government, it could be a difficult environment to make new encryption-related policies. There are a lot of different opinions and a lot of different pieces of the government that look at things from different angles and weight trade-offs differently. Right? And the way that this policy came out of was by really relentlessly focusing on explaining and on transparency. And there's more than I can show here on some of these slides, but you know, we basically kicked it off by just talking publicly in both a technical manner, but in a way that could be accessible to decision makers and to folks who aren't necessarily very technically versed about why we took why we as an organization take a super hard line about just using encrypted connections for every single thing that we do. We then continued and went and did a sort of little organizing campaign among other agencies in the federal government. And we basically, if anybody's familiar with the strict transport security preload list, you can basically bake your domain into browsers. They all share the same list pretty much at this point, and you can just have the browser enforce HTTPS at all times. So we went and organized a bunch of .gov domains to commit to that. There was no mandate or anything at the time. The FTC was incredibly helpful along the way, supported this vigorously, prioritized over the course of a few months, not just moving FTC.gov to HTTPS by default, but a number of its other supporting services, including a lot of the things that people use to report fraud. We were able to release a draft policy, and I say we at this point, I should not say we. The White House was like released a draft policy that we supported in March of 2015. And it was actually released as a draft. And that's actually not something that the government generally does for policies that face itself, right? So there's a lot of proposed rulemakings for regulations that affect the public. There's obviously all sorts of drafts of legislation that appear. But in terms of internal facing policies, up to this time, it had not really been done very much as a draft process, if at all. So we managed comments through GitHub, and that's how we hosted the website, not through GitHub Pages, but through a different Jekyll-based platform. And we took a lot of comments. We got a lot of comments from a lot of recognizable institutions, a lot of interesting individuals. And when we finalized the executive policy, we actually incorporated, you know, specific commits and pull requests and issues that people had made, you know, cited different people during the way. It was a stronger policy for that work. And in particular, the public comments helped immensely, not just from a technical space, but just in terms of validation. It really helped clear the way for that point of view to have the currency that it needed to really get over the finish line. Right? Like that public process was instrumental. So we made a little dashboard to support the work, which we open sourced. That dashboard will, you know, goes into detail about all the different sites that we could dig up on Census, who Z-maps the internet every night, and we track whether things are preloaded. We look at different things, and so we had, you know, had an actual public data component. And we also, you know, what we did was, and I say we in this case, I mean GSA and to some extent Department of Homeland Security, which I'll talk about in a minute. We had tons of different conversations over the course of implementing this policy with different agencies, where, you know, there's a lot of confusion about different parts or things that people wanted to do that maybe weren't the right way to go. And we were able to actually create a feedback loop where, as questions came up that we needed to resolve for a particular agency, we could actually go and update sort of the authoritative reference and compliance guide to reflect the answers to those questions and answer them for all the agencies. And we did this, you know, through a live kind of updating process over a couple of years, and we still update it as things come up. And that's, again, not something that usually happens in the federal government. So I won't dwell on this too much. We did, like, the actual results of migrating to HTTPS were good. Went from a clear minority to a clear majority in the U.S. government. There's a pretty credible argument that we're actually ahead of the private sector on a couple of key metrics. And that is very unusual. The U.S. government doesn't usually get to say that about technical stuff at all. But I really want to focus on some of the second order effects of working openly in this way. One of the most key things is that we got to know a lot better the Department of Homeland Security's National Cybersecurity Assessment and Technical Services Team, is abbreviated NCATS, and they offer a number of interesting services. They can do penetration tests as a free service for all sorts of government and other entities. And they also will run all sorts of scans, you know, ranging from Nessus to other more interesting stuff for agencies as a service. And we got to know their team, and they actually, that team decided to, you know, open a GitHub account, and we ended up working together on an HTTPS scanner that is their first open source project, honestly, as far as I know, like the only open source project I'm aware of that's branded as DHS on GitHub. I might have missed something. And you know, this is actually started getting. So we both use this. So DHS uses this to produce really intimidating looking reports, like PDF reports with the DHS logo on them, and then they send them all to agency security offices. So they sort of send them directly from like a scary email address right to security officers, and then GSA on our side is doing like a bright, shiny public dashboard with bright colors. And so we've essentially been using it, but we use the same code, right? We use this tool to generate the exact same results from different, we do independent scans from different vantage points, but the results are basically the same. And so we're able to sort of pincer attack agencies on driving attention and compliance to something that we think is important. This is actually a guest blog post from a member of that team who worked closely with us on that stuff. They ended up guest blogging on the 18F blog about this. And that is, I don't think DHS has ever published, and it's a technical post, right? There's like, you know, syntax highlighted technical readouts in this post. I don't think DHS has basically ever done. And so that was a really interesting thing to work through with them. And we've also gotten contributions from other agencies, so that's a NASA employee giving us a nice pull request. And NASA also recently guest blogged for us. They just went through a massive undertaking from I think January through about April, where they just decided to really go full bore on HTTPS on everything that NASA publishes that touches, that faces the public internet in any way. And they actually ended up closing down like 600 host names that responded, because essentially it forced them to inventory everything that they have. And we worked closely with them. They made use of our open source work. It was super valuable internally for them to actually drive compliance internally and have their own scanning vantage points. They've started using that on their own internal services that aren't visible from the public internet. Right, so it's basic stuff, right? But these are all like frontier kinds of things for some of these agencies. We also had our dashboard forked by a Norwegian newspaper, because it's open source, because they could, and which led to actually action by the Norwegian government from their DHS and NSA equivalents, as recommending that the Norwegian government adopt a similar policy, actually referencing the USA one. We also had our dashboard forked by a Dutch civil society organization called the Open State Foundation, and that led directly to some action by the Dutch government of holding their NIST equivalent, held a bunch of hearings building up to potential policy change. Right, and now NIST, and I think this audience will particularly love this, so NIST is now doing public comment in the same way for at least some of its publications. They recently did this with 863.3, and I bet this group probably likes that because this is the document that NIST publishes that really deals with all their password and identity stuff, right? And I love this special publication, which I don't usually say about large PDFs, but they really nailed a lot of key security stuff around passwords, right? So finally, NIST agrees with XKCD formally that, you know, passphrases are good, right? NIST now is saying, you know, specifically don't create character class requirements. And in particular, the one that I circled there is about let people paste passwords, right? So it's not explicitly being like use a password manager, but it is explicitly saying allow password managers to be used. Do not block the use of password managers. And this actually, I didn't have a screenshot of it, but that specific thing that I circled was specifically from a public commenter on their process. Like it probably would not have appeared in the document as a thing, except that a public commenter brought it up on GitHub and they hashed through it, and it was clearly a good idea. Right, so that is a new thing, and NIST actually used some 18F open source tools to actually wire up their website and manage public comment in that way. So I'll get off the US government for a bit. So I want to just now point to what I think are a few frontiers that could probably use a little bit more transparency that folks in this room may also care about or think about in their work. You know, there's a lot of certificate transparency, I think, is viewed now as a success by a lot of people, and that's why it's becoming a thing that browsers will probably just require. Like, it's already, you know, it's sort of won, right? It's through that. And so now people are looking at applying that approach, since it seems to be deployable and useful, to other things. So this is a Google blog post talking about their long-awaited key transparency effort. I say the thing that's long-awaited is that Google, in like 2013 or so, promised end-to-end mail encryption for Gmail, and people have been nagging at them for years saying, I thought you said you would do something about that. And a big part of that is dealing with key discovery and the keys of the people that you're talking with, doing that in a way that is privacy preserving and secure and usable. And so they think that key transparency is a big part of that. And so key transparency is built on the same underpinnings as certificate transparency. And actually, Google is now moving to, they have a new open source project called Trillion that is how they're starting to deploy their CT stuff, but they've explicitly made it useful as a general transparency platform for use in things like key transparency and potentially binary transparency and whatever else people might want to apply that kind of model to. A friend of mine actually just today published an Android app that whose sole job is to basically, from whatever vantage point your app is on, just take a look at, it pings all the known major CT logs and then tells a couple of auditing services, you know, what it sees from that CT log, basically to help produce to basically give people information about whether certificate transparency logs might be showing one view to somebody here and another view to somebody over here, that sort of thing. And this is just like, you know, this is like an afternoon project that is actually really profound. Like, you could give what's called a pollinator in that way to somebody and just, you know, in going about their lives on any Wi-Fi network or carrier network they're on, you know, seeing whether there's any sort of changes and just contributing to a general web PKI understanding. So another area that I care about a lot is this concept of third-party services online, which, you know, gets talked about a lot at the high level about, you know, like Facebook and Twitter setting tracking cookies and stuff like that and making use of what sites you visit and stuff to feed into ads. But it's actually a much broader issue, right? Like, it's every time you pull in a Google font, you are completely dependent on the security of the Google font server for the security of your entire session. You've obviously already sent over some data to Google Fonts. And the reality is that this stuff is insane, right? So there's this is a personal tweet, not an official work tweet or anything like that. But I did just try out in my personal capacity, like scanning for third-party host names on just the New York Times homepage, and there are 73 distinct ones, right? So some of those are owned by the New York Times, most are not, right? Most are just third parties. And if you were to go and scan news sites generally with such a thing, you would find there's some local news sites that, you know, you will download hundreds of megabytes of data from different third parties as you're just sitting there. And it's extremely corrosive to privacy and security. And there was a bit of a kerfuffle in the federal government in early 2015 when EFF correctly noted that healthcare.gov was being pretty loose with its use of third-party services, and its URLs had effectively form entries in it, like things that people had entered in previous forms about age, whether they smoke, income bracket, that were making it into the URL string, into the query string, and then getting sent as a refer header to these different third parties, right? It's a thing that people don't notice because there's, unlike HTTPS, there are no user visible indicators about this stuff at all. And so you just have this insane ecosystem completely flourishing without really any sort of oversight except by, you know, the 0.01% of people who will install Ghostery and actually care or something like that, right? So it's not a healthy ecosystem. And it's not getting a lot of attention except in little spikes here and there, and with a particularly overwhelming focus on Facebook and Twitter that I think kind of misses the forest for the trees. Something that I also think about, and I really don't know what to do about it, is that your web host or your just internet host is also a third party, right? So if you think about particularly large hosts, right, and there are several really large cloud-based hosting services, right? Literally even if, you know, the customer sites that are on them are using HTTPS, there's still a really interesting data set that is being accumulated potentially at their network edge, right? That goes across all of their customers and is really just related to a function of the size of the infrastructure behind it. You know, I've gone and I've looked through privacy policies and stuff that people publish, and it's never addressed how that stuff is handled. At best, you know, there might be a general thing that is aimed at customers of the hosts about how, you know, data generally is treated by the service provider. But in terms of just, you know, in general, any sort of obligation that they have to people's privacy at large, like, is basically not addressed. And web hosts in general are not there doesn't seem to be any push to have them disclose how they handle that information. One thing that I follow a lot is there's a big ongoing debate about HTTPS interception and about its role often in enterprises. That's usually where where these things occur, right? So you have organizations. This is very common, not just in government, but in many corporations. Just enterprises generally really want that situational awareness and visibility into traffic going on in their organization, and they are willing to just sort of bluntly intercept all HTTPS traffic to do it. So this is a paper by folks who I'm sure people in this room are familiar with, from the University of Michigan, from Mozilla, from Cloudflare, from other places. And they took advantage of a number of large pieces of infrastructure. So it was Firefox update servers, Cloudflare itself, a set of popular e-commerce sites, you could take a guess. And they basically, what they did is they learned to fingerprint the different middle boxes that were out there, whether those are physical middle boxes or whether those are antivirus pieces of software that are acting as a virtual middle box on the person's device. But essentially, these things, anything that intercepts HTTPS is, in terms of the connection that goes out to the internet, the strength of that connection is set by the middle box, right? It's no longer set by the user's browser or the user's other client. So they fingerprinted a bunch of different devices. There's some middle boxes there from a bunch of recognizable brand names. They also took a look at antivirus software. This is cut off because the list goes on for a while. Like, I can only imagine the number of, emails between lawyers that occurred as a result of them going and publishing this list. And it was really instructive of what people had sort of already, had come to a consensus about in the security community. Like, everybody knew that middle boxes were bad, but somebody had to actually go and take the time to really lay this out, explain how bad it is, really try to get that across. And it actually worked very well, right? So US CERT, shortly after that, released, HTTPS interception weakens TLS security. They didn't even caveat it, right? They just said, it weakens TLS security. And it's cut off in the screenshot, but if you scroll down, they link to this paper. It's very clearly tied to it and was the motivator for it. And that's really powerful. And then more recently, on the intelligence community and military side, the defense arm of the National Security Agency actually published a thing with a little bit more caveats. It says network security devices utilizing vulnerable weak signature algorithms. It's basically covering the same thing and for the same reasons. And that sort of dialogue, getting anybody to actually say this sort of thing and to have it to rise it up to be formally in tension with people's desire for visibility and situational awareness is super new. And it took some folks deciding to take the time to explain outside of their core group of folks. But unfortunately, there's plenty of work to do because headlines like this still come up all the time. And there's a lot of people involved there's a lot of interests represented here, to do this. And whereas the interests to not do this are much more diffuse. So it's something that needs a lot more work. So, I want to turn over to questions here. I mean, the thing I'm trying to leave from this talk is to try to communicate, the value of transparency shouldn't be all that controversial to this group or this audience, but pretty much all of the things that I showed were, controversial in some way for the person making that decision at the time or for the organization clearing that decision at the time. Each one of those steps was super hard, even though it seems like, wow, obviously they should do that. That's just what I expect from all those things. It's not easy, and most of the time it doesn't happen. And so as you go about your work, either now or in the future, and you're in organizations that are going into similar decision-making processes, right? Or you're in the position where you're even setting up a new process that might affect some part of the industry. You actually have to remember the stuff and bake it in and make it a priority for you and in your work to take the time and energy to explain things, right? To not just write papers for the groups that understand exactly what's in the paper, but to then go take the time to write an op-ed to actually describe that paper and why it's important to a broader group, right? To go and take the time to make meetings with interesting organizations to go explain that stuff. Like it can, it's non-trivial time and energy to write like a good blog post or a good article, but it is, it, those things actually move the world around. Obviously publish all the data and code that you possibly can, even when it's a little bit scary, you know, unless you have really well-grounded reasons to do so, and of course there are many situations where there are such reasons, but as a general matter, you know, really try to make a point to publish that stuff. Not controversial to an open access audience like this, but obviously academia broadly does still have some issues with this kind of approach to their work. So establishing open processes, you know, it doesn't have to be complicated, right? Like, you know, NIST was willing to establish an open process that was just like come and comment on GitHub. We, like, our employees are watching the repo, they're doing their work there anyway, they'll respond to you, they'll, you know, and stuff like that. Like, it doesn't, this doesn't have to be, you know, setting up a formal rulemaking process here. And this, I would say this is, you know, particularly important when there's a lot of acute special interests, right? Like, there's, it's almost never in individual participants' interests to have things be transparent. You have to be pretty enlightened about that. So, you know, it, when you're in the fortunate position to be able to, you know, remove, say, first mover disadvantage in a group of people by having everybody be transparent at the same time, that's the sort of thing where it's really worth placing your, really putting your political capital into it. And just like defaulting to open, right? So one of the things for me that's been really interesting is, you know, I've worked at GSA now for a few years. We just default to open. We published a lot of open source repositories, even when it's super boring and we don't think anybody is ever interested in this piece of software that we wrote. We've frequently been surprised at that. And there have been a couple of cases where it's directly led to people all of a sudden wanting to like join our organization that had never thought about working in such an organization because they saw different things that we published or because we interacted with them and we accepted their contributions and that was a rush to them and very surprising. Like that sort of thing is really common. And I would say, you know, there's a lot of folks, and this comes up in open source a lot, where there's an acute focus that folks have on not wanting to like rush into open source, like either not wanting to publish things until they feel clean, or not feeling prepared to like support a community where to arise, or feeling that it's only worth publishing if it's potentially interesting to a large enough community. And I would really push to just you know, put the burden on the other side, right? Like, we really have to justify not publishing something. So that's the end of my talk, and I'm happy to turn it over to Q&A, and thanks for having me this morning.
Hi, thank you for the talk. That was really interesting. You mentioned that, you talked about how the US government had this push to get HTTPS deployed on all the government sites. And then you mentioned that healthcare.gov was caught kind of accidentally pushing out data. Do you think there could be a similar drive to kind of try and clear up that kind of thing throughout the government websites? And how could that look?
I think there absolutely could be. It's sort of about, you know, finding the one thing that has been surprising to me is that in especially such a very large bureaucracy as the US government, like, individuals make a huge difference if they choose to spend their time and energy on a particular focus area. And I think really it's a matter of somebody taking up that cause. So, you know, actually going and scanning for how third-party services are used, whether you're using a headless scanner like PhantomOS or like PhantomJS, or Chrome did a headless browser, like you could absolutely do that, right? And you could, it doesn't even have to be somebody inside the government, right? These are all publicly accessible things. If, you know, but if you were, the way that's, what's important to do that is, you know, you do the technical work, you generate the spreadsheet or whatever it is, but then you take the time to pull out what's important about that. And one of the things that was useful to learn during the HTTPS work was how much work it took to boil something down to be simple. Right, like we wanted to present people with like, are you using HTTPS? Are you enforcing it? And do you have strict transport? And answering those questions was actually super challenging. Right, like is what if it's different whether www is in front of it or not? Or like what if they redirected themselves in a weird way? Right, or like all there's all these edge cases that I think that would be the interesting part with scanning for third parties, is doing the work of figuring out which ones matter, which ones don't, right? Not wanting to alert fatigue site operators. Doing the extra work to like analyze when URLs might be being passed in a way that's not ideal, and then also like trying to decide, it probably takes more effort to go and look not just at the home page, but at how different subpages work within it, and especially logged in environments. And so those are all interesting things. I think anybody could do that. I think it would be very interesting.
Hello, just anecdotally, I worked for a company that started offering a service a little while back, and we used strict transport. And I was a bit shocked to discover how many organizations are intercepting TLS traffic. Yeah. But at least when we were contacted, we had the opportunity to talk to the customer about what was going on and sort of direct them to their IT stuff. I'm wondering if you have, or if the particular agencies that are now running strict transport have, in a sense, a guidance to people who are finding themselves or finding their browsers are blocking the connections.
Right. Well, the truth of it is that browsers really don't do much to help detect or prevent interception, right? So strict transport still works, even if the cert has been replaced. Public key pinning, it's been implemented in Chrome and Firefox, and both of them allow locally installed routes to override those protections. And they have a really clear set of reasons for doing that, right? Though there's also pretty strong reasons for elevating some transparency within that. But the effort that I talked about around the HTTPS policy has really not touched interception-related stuff. There's not guidance about that that's up there. It's clearly more controversial in some ways, and so I definitely wanted to point to some of the agencies which have started to stick their necks out on it and raise that conversation, and I would reach out to those agencies if you want to talk with them more about their work. Yeah.
Hi, so this is really interesting stuff. My name's Adam Aviv, I'm at the Naval Academy, so I'm in the DoD side of the world, and in the government, and our security certificate situation is a nightmare. So I was wondering if 18F has thought about coming over and offering services within that department, or is there any cross communication? I'll give you a really great example. So when Chrome downgraded the SHA protocol, Everyone was like, we've never heard of this thing. And we were like, here's the blog post. It was announced years ago. And then every website broke. And they don't distribute certificates out with like the Mozilla standard certificate package. So it looks like everything's insecure. Their signing policies are really terrible. I don't think you have an answer, but we're a mess.
I do actually have a couple of things. One is... There's a group called the Department of Defense. It's the Defense Digital Service. And I would reach out to them. This is something that they take an interest in. It's a branch of the U.S. Digital Service that is embedded pretty high up in DoD, and they really care about issues like this, and this issue in particular. I would actually reach out to them using whatever DoD channels are appropriate. The other thing that I'll mention is this is an effort between DoD and GSA. I don't know if that's going to... be easy to see, probably not. It's an attempt to, we're creating a CP and a CPS for a new PKI that the civilian and military sides will operate together, where they'll sort of share routes and then create different issuing CAs. And at this point, it's very easy to get involved, especially if you're inside the government. There's a lot of really interesting working groups, and DoD participation is obviously pretty paramount to get ground reality. So,
hey, Dan Cosley, NSF and Cornell University. So I have two related questions. One is sort of a positive, one is sort of a negative. They're actually kind of dual questions, right? One is, you've been thinking about this for a while. You've looked at some particular examples. Presumably, you've got some spaces in your mind that are not as transparent as you would like them to be, but there are particularly, to use the word you used earlier, juicy, right? And so it would be interesting to hear what places you think would be sort of most interesting to move into, and then kind of the opposite side of that, right? You've been sort of telling this story about transparency is awesome. There are probably boundaries, and it'd be interesting to hear a little bit about where you see the boundaries.
There are plenty of boundaries. Yeah, I mean, you know, partly what I was trying to focus on here were some areas that I think do merit, that I think, you know, need some infusion, and which there is some juicy stuff, right? There's, you know, when showing up to the HTTPS website and relying on connections to 70 other ones is pretty interesting. I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to broader, so, you know, zooming out a little bit, right, there's a big culture clash and skill set clash between, I think, in enterprise IT security, right? You can see a little bit of that right now. If you go on the TLS working group, there's a recent back and forth between folks who have come in from the financial and, like, regulated sector and asked for, like, essentially an extension for TLS 1.3 that doesn't require forward secrecy, so that they can implement a network-based decryption model for traffic within their own data center, though obviously the controversial concerns are like, well, what if somebody just takes that and applies it outside of the data center? Sorry. And that kind of thing comes up a lot, right? Like, it comes up especially in the interception world too, and then about what the future of enterprise IT should be. You have, at the one end, you have like Google's BeyondCorp, right, where they've actually scrapped the network entirely, you know, or to some asymptotic extent, right, and they have everything out on the public internet. And then, you know, most organizations are going to be on some interesting spectrum between here and there. But that future where you're actually trying to have logic and software be your boundary instead of a physical network-based boundary is, to me, a very interesting space that is where most of the battles are being fought now, inside and outside. A couple of the things I brought up here, interception included, relate to that. And I think a big part of what is preventing those debates from being settled and causing people to continue to rely on physical perimeters for their security, kind of no matter how much is they're told maybe not to, or they just keep hearing about the cloud and mobile devices and keep wanting them to go away, is that they're not being shown viscerally the downsides of their approach, right? They're not being shown viscerally, actually, all the attacks are over here, right? Or like, these are the threats that are actually draining people of their money and time, and this approach that you're taking doesn't seem to line up with that threat model, right? And I think I'm speaking deliberately kind of vaguely here, because it's a universe of problems, but I think they all relate to, like, are we willing to trust software to be the boundary, and are we willing to invest in the skill sets inside our enterprises to actually focus a little more on engineers and less away from some of the roles that people have invested in historically over time inside the enterprise? Sorry how vague that is, but I think that's where the fight is.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.